certified sex addiction therapist specializing in LGBTQIA plus issues, sexual behavior, and mental health. Our very welcome guest today is Brandon Simpson, joining us from California. He holds a master's in clinical psychology from Antioch University and works at Novus Mindful Life Institute, focusing on the important topics of non-judgmental, sex-positive therapy for individuals, navigating societal expectations, sexual identity, and compulsive behaviors. And this topic has never been more important globally, that we recognize and understand and empathize with other people. That's what life should be about, really. His approach emphasizes aligning personal beliefs with lived experiences to reduce anxiety, shame, and trauma stemming from societal norms around sex and gender. So an incredibly challenging role, but something that I know Brandon does incredibly well, and he's really adding value to the community that he serves. So Brandon, you're very welcome. I just wanted to start a little bit with your background. I don't know too much about you as a younger person. So what was life like growing up? How did your early years help create the person that's been kind enough to join us today?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned it. I currently live in Los Angeles, California. I have not always lived in Los Angeles, California. I am one of, I'd say, millions of people who, you know, take the trip from wherever they were born, where they were raised, and moved to sunny California. Mm-hmm. I lived in California since about 2017, mid-2017. Before then, I actually lived in New York, but I didn't live in completely New York different. City. Yeah, yeah. I lived actually, it's about 2 hours north of Manhattan and the boroughs. Very red county here in the States. We describe everything as blue and red politically. So yes. very red county, surrounded by red counties. And I lived in New York until I was about 22, 23. And then that's when I say it was for the winters. I do not like the cold. I never really liked the winters. And so I decided one winter that like I was done with it. But I think it's also, California is a lot more accepting place. It's a lot more, hey, you're here. Like, we appreciate you being here. So it was a journey.
And how do you find living in Los Angeles? I've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time in New York and Chicago and different parts of California. I always find Los Angeles very, very sprawling. San Francisco, I understand. San Diego, I understand. Los Angeles, I always struggle with understanding, well, where's the center? Where I think it didn't feel like the other cities, really. So do you feel very comfortable there and very at home, and does a good community feel?
Yeah, I've lived in different pieces of Los Angeles since I've been here. So I'm almost 10 years here now. So I've lived in different pieces of Los Angeles County, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's pockets is really what we do really well here in Los Angeles is it's not like, you know, Castro Street in San Francisco. It's not like, you know, Fire Island in New York, it's not this one concentrated place, which I think Los Angeles does really well, is it's very dispersed. Yeah. You know, we have Silver Lake has its own, which is a city here in Los Angeles, where they focus on like one type of person. You know, Silver Lake is known as like the more artistic, more hippie kind, not really hippie, but like it's the more artistic place where you're going to find a lot more creative people over there. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to find on the west side, you know, Santa Monica, Venice, Marina Del Rey, you're going to find a little more upscale places. But they still, every single hub or kind of sphere of living has their own, you know, LGBTQ population. And they find the little, you know, I think the one thing that we do really well is we find our little pockets of homes so that we can find those spaces to find each other.
So being on the sort of East Coast and then moving over to the West Coast, what led you to the career path that you're on today? So I've always thought of people that are strong enough to take on the role, the responsibility that you have. It's almost feels a calling as much as a career? And I just wonder what drove you to be where you are today?
Yeah, so actually when I was growing up and when I actually started college, I never thought about becoming a therapist. I actually was going to school to be a high school biology teacher. So a lot of right Different. Before I started, yeah. So right before I started my psychology track, I was getting prepared to do my student teaching. I was getting ready to, taking classes in microbiology and all of that. And I think it was just one day it turned and I was like, this doesn't feels like work. And not that work should feel like work.
No, I understand.
It just felt like so much work and effort. And I was like, it brings me joy, but not enough joy.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of when I decided to make the shifts. And so I took a few psychology classes that are required of us, everyone mm-hmm. to take in universities out here. And I was like, I really liked it. And so that's when I decided to change the major. But I didn't really consider becoming a therapist until I kind of moved out here, moved out to California. It was the next logical steps to do. But it's not that I don't pull like the empathy and all that from my experiences, because I remember growing up in, upstate New York and being that lonely kid, didn't really know where to fit in, who didn't really, I remember having friends, but they weren't like those deeper friendships. Of course, because growing up as a gay boy, you don't put yourself all the way out there because it means pain.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the experience that I pulled in, be like, oh no, I want to help other people that are going through that.
And are you glad that you're now doing what you're doing and not that biology teacher?
Yeah, I think I am very happy with what I do. I love helping people. It was interesting. So I was on vacation for a month. And then when I came back, this week is my first week back at work. And I was, I'm excited to see all my patients. I'm excited to see what they've been without me for about a month, maybe 3 weeks. And so I'm excited to hear what they've been going through, what's going on, like to check in with them, to be able to, I gave all my patients tasks to do while I was gone. So to see how did their tasks go, what challenges did they go through that they wished I was there for to kind of help them through? How did they kind of adapt to it? And, I'm kind of glad I made that switch.
Mm. That's good. A lot of friends that I have in the UK actually, and in Australia and the US, a lot of people that go into formal education, i.e. teaching, etc., they come to a point where, certainly in the UK, they spend so much time not teaching and doing the administration mm-hmm. around teaching, and they have no control over the lesson plan as such. They have to sort of follow what the state or the government dictates. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that do it for X number of years and become quite frustrated and want to do something else. And I think what you're doing, you have that hopefully amazing experience of seeing people develop and seeing people understand themselves more. I certainly wouldn't say, you see people get better, because I have no idea what that means. But I think it's more about people understanding themselves and understanding how people react to them, etc., and that's what I think so interesting. And it's very interesting. You've been away for for quite a challenging time in the US, to be fair. So you were away just after the inauguration. So, and obviously we've already seen that the US is changing. I know California is a very strong blue state as opposed to mm-hmm. the rest that you're talking about. Do you think when you talk to clients again, people will be more fearful? They'll be more uncertain again. They'll be just what's going to happen type questions?
Yeah. I've been processing with my patients since the election results were certified. Even in California, we still talk about the stresses, even though California has such a hard, mm-hmm. it's really hard to move California. And so even though we are such, it is such a sturdy state, the fear is still there because, you know, I think I heard it was, you know, not too long ago, I heard somewhere where it was positioned that California won't receive aid unless they do XYZ.
Yes.
From the federal government. And I'm like, that's people's lot. Like, those are your constituents. Yeah. Like, even if we didn't, like, you know, there's everyone in every state that have both political affiliation. So, you know, especially with the devastating fires, you know, some of those people were your constituents. And so it's like, you're willing to, just because the state has this very specific colored or definition of ideologies that, you know, everyone has to suffer, and it's, you're willing to kind of play with people's lives. And it's very stressful for a lot of my patients. And I think as the government starts pulling back their, you know, their diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, as federal funding starts getting pulled, you know, before I became a therapist full time, I worked in HIV prevention. And I worked underneath a lot of grant work and federal monies and things like that. And, you know, a lot of the people were really thankful for the services we provided. And I was actually just talking to my old boss the other day, and she was telling me that she, this is the most she's cried. She cries every day when she goes into work because she doesn't know who she's going to have to let go. And it's day by day. She's like, I don't know if I just have to fire staff. And she's like, that's so disheartening.
Yeah. And I can't imagine that those sort of places were overstaffed before. They're probably running quite lean as it was, really. So you work with families and individuals, and I know there's no such thing as a standard discussion, but what do people come to you for? What do they expect? And what do they sort of hope for when they come and talk to you?
Various things. So, you know, when I work with, I usually separate my groups of patients between my sex addiction patient, the sex or porn addiction patients, and then my non-sex or porn addiction patients. So really just depends on which group I'm seeing. My non-sex and porn addiction patients, you know, it is a lot of the depressions, the anxieties. A lot of those depressions and anxieties are fueled by their traumas and their experiences. So we really dive in and impact, kind of unpack a lot of their experiences so that they have a better, like you said, they have a better understanding of themselves, and they know what works and what doesn't work. For my sex and porn addiction patients, they are just worried about sobriety and their sense of sobriety, but doesn't mean that we don't do the same thing. So a lot of my sex and porn addiction patients, they are highly anxious. They're highly depressive. Yeah. They have a bunch of unresolved trauma that we have to like deep dive into and be able to understand that their behaviors are only a manifestation of it. That they've used those behaviors to cope. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's find a different coping mechanism for all of that.
It's very interesting. I've been talking to various people over the last month or so about the impact or influence of porn on society, on our young people, etc. And I think the statistics vary, I guess, but the average age, I think, a boy encounters porn today is 12, which is certainly very different from, I mean, when I was growing up, you might have sneaked a peek at your dad or older brother's Playboy that was hidden at the bottom of the wardrobe or whatever, and that was like, my God, there's a picture of a naked woman or a naked man, or depending on your preference, whatever. And like, my gosh. Whereas now, yeah, that isn't porn compared to what people see now. And I think, and do you find when you sort of talk to people that they have had early encounters and I don't have an issue with porn per se. And there's people I talk to in the industry, people that have that use porn in a responsible manner. But I think if you're accessing it if you're 11, 12, you don't really understand what a relationship is. You don't understand what consent is. You don't understand what a lot of the things are. Is that something that people talk about, that they access it so early on, it sort of almost guided or defined how they viewed sexuality and sex?
Yeah, so it's usually a combination. So I want to say that one part is definitely that, you know, it's the early exposure. You know, they find the Playboy, they find the Playgirl, they find the Esquire, they find the Sports Illustrated bathing suit catalog. That's one piece of it. And then usually what I ask my patients is, how were your parents around sex? You know, and that's the second piece, is how has your parent, not yours, but the general your parents, set you up to be a sexual person? Because their shame or guilt or their embarrassment around sex, you know, always translates down to the child. And so I've had patients who are like, who have told me, like I told my dad and he was like, don't ever do that again. Or you don't do that during the day. Or, you know, they put heavy shame rather than, you know, and it is, for children, it is a very natural curiosity. What is this? What does this mean? And depending on the parent's reaction or how the parents have set up that streamline of communication between them and their children, the quality of that communication and the parent's own shame and guilt and things like that kind of really translate down to the children. So it's the piece of being curious, which never is a bad thing. But it takes a little extra to be able to dive into the irresponsible use of porn and sexual contact and things like that.
Yeah, and it's almost this sort of irony that when you think about other addictions that people perhaps are more used to historically, so whether it's alcohol or narcotics or whatever, even an addiction to work, we're going to say, but there's Most children will have seen their parents drink and smoke and do lots of other things. And even if it's drugs, people tend to do it around other people. But porn, we tend to sort of sit and sort of look at or read porn in the main living room, or we don't go into work and say, oh gosh, I'm so tired. I spent all night looking at porn last night. We don't. We might say, oh gosh, I'm so tired. I spent all night clubbing and I drank so much. You might say that, but it is. And I think some of that, I guess, comes from, how our parents were taught by their parents. And I think if you go back and look at the perhaps puritanical views of different religious teachings and the different views we have, and I think that must influence almost a stigma around porn in a way. Because it's such a massive industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. It's not a small industry by any means. I think Pornhub gets 3 billion views a month. I mean, that's half the world population. So it's not tiny. So somebody in your house is watching it, no matter what you might think. And I think, there must be something around how people have been brought up in that religious. And exactly as you say, you know, don't do that, you'll go blind. Or it's just so crazy. But we don't have a sense
of it's one of the things, you know, it's usually sex and money are the two things are very uncomfortable talking to children about. Mm-hmm. You know, having the talk about sex and porn and, you know, puberty and things like that. And that's also money, which is why a lot of people start getting into that, you know, that age where they have to get into their own finances, that they're like, I don't know what to do. Like, how do I balance my, especially now, you know, children are like, what's a checkbook?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do I balance a checkbook? What do I need to do? Like, it's on the scale of one of the things that parents don't like to talk about, because either one, they're winging it, which is completely okay, or they don't know themselves, which is completely okay. Yeah. But it perpetuates that into their children.
Mm. And do you think that there is still a societal expectation around what normal, in inverted commas, sexuality is? And is there still potentially a feeling of shame that people have if they are part of the LGBTQIA plus community? Does that still exist?
Oh yeah, there's still this, and it's interesting because that standard or like that expectational line, it isn't clearly defined.
Okay.
You know, it is different for every single person, for every single family. And yes. Depending on who you talk to, the line moves.
Mm-hmm.
And it is never clear of where the line is. And I say that because it, you know, 12 is around the age we're seeing where kids are being exposed to porn. I think I saw the statistic last week. It was like one in seven children, if not one in five children, will be exposed to pornographic material. And, you know, around 12, that's mm-hmm. the age where children start pulling away from the family unit. They start going yeah. in, really relying on their friend group. So, you know, there's this standard for the family, but then as they're transitioning out, their friend group has a different standard.
Yes.
But they're also still trying to remember the family group standard. And it's this convoluted confusion of like, what is right? What is wrong? You know, I find this pleasing because, you know, I can be, you know, the dopamine is going, the serotonin is going.
Yeah.
But I'm getting told by either one or both groups that this isn't right. So it's like, how, you know, for a child, you know, it's like, what do I do?
Yeah. Yeah, it was very hard. Since I was growing up in a, almost feels like before technology existed, but there weren't dating apps like Grindr or Tinder or mm-hmm. different variations of that. So do you think that's changed our approach to sex and sexuality in a positive way? And the reason I asked is that a few of my friends are on the apps. They said typically, again, it's not, there's no such thing as a standard, but typically they feel like they're more for hookups than long-term relationships. Mm-hmm. Some people do meet the long-term partner, but I just wonder whether that is a route that people have to, yeah, to become the person they need to be or the person that they are.
Yeah. So I always say the apps have two faces. You know, mm-hmm. the apps on one side can be really great. They're really positive. You know, they break the mold on dating and relationship building. But I think you are correct where, you know, pieces of relationships are sexual. And so
yep.
that's the second phase where it can be very sexualized. It not that porn is already not at our fingertips, but we have to go out and go look for it. You know, you have to type in the URL, you have to find the video, you have to, you know, then you get to the porn.
Mm-hmm.
With the apps, you know, it is just right there.
Yeah.
It is usually within the first few messages, or if, you know, if the person is only looking for hookups, you know, that's right out of the gate. There's no, hi, how are you? There is just straight yeah. to the point. And so it is this, how do you navigate that field? And that is, especially with a lot of my patients that are both LGBTQ and have these perplexities around sex and porn, it is mm-hmm. this moment they're like, how do you separate the two? Especially since the two are so interconnected, you know, when a child, teen, young adult come out and they're like, oh, I'm gay, I'm lesbian, and, you know, I prefer this person of this sex or gender, you know, the very first question a lot of people ask is, well, have you ever had sex with someone like that? So how do you know you're like that? So they really tie the identities in with the acts of sex. And that gets pushed in. That gets pushed into adulthood. That get those two things, even though they are not mutually exclusive, but they make them too intertwined, where it starts really having the client or a lot of my patients really second guess their identities in some form. You know, my LGBTQ patients, they're like, no, I'm gay, but like, it means to be gay, you have to be hypersexual, you have to always be horny, you have to always want sex. And I have to usually tell them, be like, no, those two do not equal each other.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, my friend group says that. I'm like, yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about that a little bit.
It is yeah, it is funny. It's going to sound really weird. I moved to London when I was 18 from a sort of small town in the middle of the country. And I hadn't knowingly met anybody that identified as gay or lesbian or bisexual. Obviously, there were some people that were, but it certainly was never sort of talked about at school. And when I came to London, I went to work at Harrods, a big store in the menswear department. And so it was a real eye-opener in terms of the conversations, okay. The discussions I had. There were so many people there that very openly sort of discussed sexuality. And it was wonderful just hearing people having different lives, different views, whatever. But I very quickly, yeah, recognised, having talked to people, that there were people that went out in the evenings or and met somebody and in the park or wherever. And then mm-hmm. next night, somebody else. And the other people that have been in relationships for 30 years. And it was almost that thing, well, no, if you're gay, then you must be like this. Or if you're lesbian, mm-hmm. you must be like this. Almost as, whereas you think, well, but people that aren't gay are very different from one another. Some people are very sexually oriented and want to be out dating somebody new every night. Some people have been married for 25 years. So it is odd that there's almost that, no, if you're gay, you must be like this. But I think mm-hmm. the more people get to know, get to learn, get to talk about those things, the better, I think. Just on the something you said before, and this is what I've always understood to be right, and I'm glad you said it, that so porn addiction, sex addiction, as with alcohol or drugs, tends to be the result as opposed to what's somebody suffering with or a trauma that it might feel or some sort of something that's deeper down. It isn't the fact that you're addicted to porn, it's something else. So how do you help people get to the realization that it's not about just watching porn less often, it's about understanding what it is that you might be driven to use this as a sign for something else. How did you get to the something else?
You know, my training is through the International Institute of Trauma and Addiction Professionals, or ITAP.
Yep.
And they, you know, that's where my certified sex addiction therapist credentials come from. And, you know, and it's founded by a man named Patrick Carnes. And mm-hmm. Patrick Carnes is amazing. I was able to hear him lecture and everything. And he's been doing this work since the 70s. And it was a time where before it was an accepted view, which is argumentative, which is it still really, you know, is sex and porn addiction real?
Yeah.
I get all the time. And I'm like, yes, it is. But Patrick Carnes, he has been doing this battle for well over 50 years. And, you know, it is that, you know, porn and sex are just the surface. You know, we are sexual, you know, humans are sexual beings, but something has happened that's the go-to stress reliever. And that's most times what it is, you know, something stressful has happened in your life, in your day. And, you know, where some people would turn to have a drink or, you know, do a substance of choice, you know, some of my patients, they just go to porn or they go to hookups and mm-hmm. masturbate, things like that. And so we try to find anything, you know, how does it feel to go for a walk? You know, if you're stressed out and you don't know what to do, you know, go for a walk, go exercise, you know, let's meditate for a little bit. Let's do some mm-hmm. breathing exercises. So it is these alternatives that kind of help rewire the way that, one, my patients see stress, but then how they cope with the stress. Because it is very easy for, you know, us to sit down on the couch and say, wow, I had a stressful day, turn on the television, and the first commercial that came on is the Chanel commercial. Because you see Charlize Theron just walk out of a pool, you know, half naked. So it's like, oh, that yes. looks good. That feels good. Let me get more of that.
Yeah.
And that's usually the piece that we have to start separating out. I usually recommend all my patients for when we very first start working together is let's become sober for a little bit. Let's, you know, if you, we are going through this stressful time and therapy is very stressful.
Mm-hmm.
You have someone who is like, what does that mean for you? What are those emotions? You know, we're trying to pick at different aspects of an individual who may not want to either look at those things or have never looked at those things in a very long time.
Yeah.
And so I usually tell my patients as we do that, we want something else as your go-to.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take the porn out. Let's delete the hookup apps. Let's put some website blockers on your phone, on your laptop, on your smart TV, so that as we're going through these stressful times that we can figure out what can be just as helpful during those stressful moments.
Yeah. And I was just thinking as you were saying that, so with alcohol, for example, so I've been sober for, 14 years now, I think. Okay. And I'm not gonna have, if I, I'm not gonna, I don't, not planning to have another drink. But I, I don't think I would be able to have a sort of healthy relationship with alcohol. And that's one of the challenges. Obviously, porn's different, I guess, but sex, you sort of think, well, how do you get to a stage where you have a healthy relationship with sex? But then I was thinking, well, it's the sex that people are having to get away from the stress of the day or the challenges of the habit, it's different sex. It's not mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it's a normal relationship with sex, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm explaining it very, very badly. But yeah, so I was thinking, gosh, so if you tend to drink or take drugs or eat, you sleep, you've got to stop.
You can stop, generally. Yeah.
Yeah, but with sex, you hopefully still want to be able to have sex, but it's recognizing that there are different types of sex in terms of emotions and you know, one night stands is all fine, nobody's saying that, no, but it's recognizing and just changing the relationship you have with sex mm-hmm. and other people, I guess.
Yeah, it is this moment that we have to, you know, in a neurobiological way, we have to rewire the brain.
Yes,
because when patients first come to us and they're mm-hmm. like, I need to get sober, I don't like the sex I'm having, or I don't like how much porn I'm watching, that's been years. And I usually, here in California, we're known for all of our freeways.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, and usually I tell my patients, it's like, you've built a 6-lane freeway from the pleasure center to the part of the brain that activates when you see porn. You have built that freeway there, and it is a healthy freeway. It is a well-working freeway. And same thing with sex. If you're about to be sexual or masturbate or have sex with someone else, you're going to ride that freeway quick. And I usually tell my patients, I was like, we have to, one, you know, you don't just destroy a freeway. You have to, one, make sure all the cars stop using the freeway. Then you have to get the demolition team ready for the, you know, breaking down the freeway. Then we break down the freeway. Then we rebuild something else. So like, I usually have to let them know it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And the hope is that we build the freeway to go somewhere else. So instead of the area of the brain that activates when we watch porn, you know, maybe it's the deep breathing exercises. Mm-hmm. It's the positive connections that you have, social connections that you have. That's where we want to rebuild that freeway.
Mm.
And instead of, you know, it being a freeway from sex to the pleasure center or porn to the pleasure center of the brain, we want to build maybe, you know, a back road. Not to say that it's not useful and that you're not going to use it, but we don't want it to be as readily available.
Yeah.
And I think it is, you didn't mention something, it is understanding the type of sex that someone's having, the mm-hmm. type of porn that they're watching, because one, sex sells in this world. So everything is sexual. And if you're in a relationship, you know, that's a piece of the relationship is to be sexual. But instead of, instead of focusing on the acts, you know, the sex positions, the amount of time you have sex, the, you know, the ejaculation, if you will, how do we really focus on the emotional connection? How do we build the emotional connection into that experience so that can be a little more uplifting rather than, you know, rather than degrading?
I think the freeway is a wonderful analogy, because you sort of, and I first thing to do is get out the carpool lane. But then after that, you, and sometimes you can sort of sat on the freeway and you think, oh, I've just driven 100 miles, and I have no idea how I got here. It's just so straightforward, and everything's going at the same pace, all the speed. But if you're on a back road or a quiet road, you've got to pay attention. So it's almost the same, isn't it? So rather than on this freeway, it's just you're powering to your destination. And you know, it doesn't matter how you get there, you're just going to get there. Whereas the side roads, you've really got to pay attention to the map, might not even be on a sat nav, and you've got to be aware of what's happening around you. I think that's a wonderful analogy. I really do. So something else I think that's perhaps spoken about more in the last few years, maybe decades. Think of the book 50 Shades of Grey and all of its sort of sibling books or whatever, and things like that. It's started to bring different things that some people might see as a kink or something different more into society. And I wondered if you have people that come into therapy that somehow feel what they're doing is wrong, or they feel like they want to live a polyamorous lifestyle, or they want to be into BDSM or whatever. How do we get past people feeling that those are wrong and that they are, I don't know, some society would say, oh, it's deviant behavior. You hear people say that. Well, of course it's not. And you think, if it's consensual, if it's disgust or whatever, you sort of think it's just part of life. It's sad. Do you get people that come to you that feel shame for the way that they feel?
Yeah. And it's around BDSM, around kinks, around ethical non-monogamy, even around porn. So I definitely had patients come in and they're like, oh, I have a porn addiction. But, you know, when they took their intake forms and everything, I look at like their indicators, and they've only scored a 2, because it's the 2 questions that they answered were around shame.
Yeah.
Shame about the actions that they're doing. So I usually have to ask them, like, well, do you have a porn addiction, or do you just not like the, you know, type of porn that you're watching, or is it something else? And so, I get people who are very shameful about the desires that they have. And I think that's where the sex positivity tends to come in. Be like, hey, that's a normal want, desire. That's a normal area to want to explore.
Yeah.
And I usually then, especially with the polyamories, the ethical non-monogamies, we usually really work into the consent piece.
Yeah.
But what does it look like to be like, to have that relationship type?
Mm-hmm.
What are the do's? What are the don'ts? What are the rules? What are the regulations? Because if you don't have those and you just go into it, a lot of my patients were like, well, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, were your boundaries respected? They're like, oh, well, I didn't set up any. Like, that's why you don't like it.
Yeah.
With the kinks, like the BDSMs, the wit plays, a bunch of different things. I get that too. And I usually tell them, because where I work in West Hollywood, there's a sex shop right there in West Hollywood. It's called the Pleasure Chest. And so normally they do classes. So I usually recommend my patients just go to a class. You don't have to dive into it. You don't have to find like a dungeon and just like say, give me everything. I was like, I've been to a few, you know, I wouldn't refer my patients to someplace I wouldn't go to. And I was like, just go to one of the classes.
Yeah.
Just sit there and listen. You don't have to participate. If you're just like, I'm here to gain information, I was like, they'll help guide you through that.
Yeah. And a lot of that guilt or shame sort of thing must come from upbringing and the surroundings that people have. And not that parents necessarily would talk about the sort of things, but just that feeling that sex is for procreation, it's very vanilla, and anything outside of that is off the table. And so then you almost gets built up to be a bigger and bigger thing, because you're not sort of gently exploring it or talking about it or, like you say, being educated. But I think that's a really good tip, is to go and there's lots of places that will educate people, guide them, talk about it. It's not a case of having to sort of rock up at a swingers party and say, right, here I am. It's that we're hoping not. That might work, but I think it's like with alcohol. You're not going to slam a bottle of tequila on your first time drinking. Hopefully, let's just see if you like it. You might like something else.
And I think you brought it up, is that a lot of people, they have that idea that sex is just for procreation. You're supposed to just be able to reproduce. It is between a man and a woman, and it is, at most it's missionary, and you're not supposed to really like it.
Yeah.
But, and I think that's where I really like helping a lot of my patients rewrite their stories. Now, that may be their parents' story, and 9 times out of 10, I tell them, I don't believe that's their story. Or they wouldn't be coming in to talk about these kinds of things, or they wouldn't be asking for help. So I usually tell them, like, let's rewrite that chapter in your book. That could be a story you were told. We were all told stories about the troll under the bridge, the princess high in the tower, but we don't go to bridges and look underneath to make sure the troll is there. We don't see a high tower and we're like, oh, there has to be a princess there. We build our own expectations around the stories and understand that, the stories that we're told sometimes don't translate into our actual real life.
It's funny, isn't it? Funny you said that, just those fairy tales and stories you sort of get told as a child and things. That sort of kissing a frog and all these things. And we start off by lying to our children. It's really, that's the first thing we do to them. We sort of hear about, what do you want to do at Halloween? Oh, I'll be the princess, and I'll be the prince, and I'll be the... And you sort of bring in those, and they tend to be very gender stereotyped. And it's very odd that we haven't... Those fairy tales go back hundreds of years that we haven't necessarily moved on massively quickly going forward. So a lot of the work you do is with people that come in, recognizing there's perhaps something about their behavior not comfortable with, and they might want to make a change, which is good. But when you have people that have experienced different types of trauma, sort of sexual or otherwise, how do you handle that? That's quite a different conversation, I guess.
Yeah. So when if there are talks and things like that, if I find that some of my patients do have underlying trauma, we usually try to figure out what does it look like for the trauma to get activated. For any, what I tell a lot of my patients is that a trauma is a threat to your life. Now, it could be a physical threat, it could be a perceived threat, or it can be an imaginary threat, but it's a threat. And so when we go into certain situations, what our body and our subconscious mind really likes to do is it scans the situation for dangers. It looks for red flags. Oh, this looks kind of scary. This person doesn't look very safe, so I may stay away from them. This person over here, they look cool, so maybe they might be interested in what I'm interested in, so maybe I'll go talk to them. I usually like to explain to my patients that a brain without trauma can pick up on the nuances. They can pick up on the green flags. They can pick up on the light green flags. They can pick up on the red flags, and it can pick up on the pink flags. Now, a brain of someone who has experienced a trauma, they don't know the nuances. The nuances are very unsafe for a person like that. So what could be a pink flag, the brain isn't going to question it as a pink flag. It's going to exacerbate it up to a red flag, because it's better safe than sorry. The brain's only going to see red and green. They're not going to see the lights or the gradients, because that's potential danger. the brain is like, I've already been in danger once. I'm not going to do it again. And so what I do with a lot of my patients is help them recognize the gradients. Things aren't so black and white. They're not reds and green flags. There are these gradients. And just because something is pink doesn't mean it's going to be an immediate danger.
Yeah.
And that's one step, is to work with my patients to be able to have that recognition. And then the second step is, what do we do? You know, how do we, you know, what are even some actions that we can do, or what are some coping mechanisms that that can help us be exposed to the stress for a little bit longer? Because the brain is really good at red flag, I'm going to run. Green flag, I'm going to go towards it. And it doesn't know what to do with the gradients. So we have to start, you know, behavior modification. You know, what do we do in those moments? How do we react? How can we react differently? And it's usually, hey, if you have that sense to run, you know, fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, take 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Take 5 minutes before you do any action and see what happens.
Mm.
And then usually after a few times, my patient's like, yeah, I was able to do that. Okay, now let's do it longer. We're going to double the time. And usually that's why I get the big huff of the, like, Brandon, you're challenging me. I said, yes, that's literally my job, is to challenge you and help you through this.
Because it's yeah. And I've been, yeah, lucky enough that people have sort of talked to me about this situation. And I've found as people I've talked to tend to fall into one of two camps. Somebody that's perhaps lived in a home where there's maybe abuse in the home, or one of the partners is not a good person, in very simplistic language. They'll either, like you say, rail against that completely and sort of be fearful of anything that comes, or they'll almost recognize that as being a normal relationship. And yeah. I talked to a lady a few weeks ago, and she's very open, and she sort of talked about going from one bad relationship to the other, because that's all she'd ever known growing up, was that. And eventually she got help. She had sort of therapy that talked about, well, actually, no, your self-worth and who you are as a person. And I think she just hadn't understood that, and you put it perfectly before, that her mum's story in this case wasn't her story, but she was she was reliving that story. She was almost the sequel. She was like the story too.
Yeah,
and it took a therapist to talk to her about, well, actually, let's look at your story. And I think that was such a good way of putting it, is that you're writing your own story. You'll have inputs from everywhere, but you don't just have to copy down what you did, what everybody else did before. So no, really interesting.
Yeah. I, it's this, you know, I tell a lot of my patients who do come to me for, like, relationships and things like that, they're like, it's just one failed relationship after another. I'm like, what was your idea of a relationship growing up?
Yeah.
Like, well, and they tell me, they're like, well, mom always had a round of boyfriends coming in. You know, they would always fight. They would, you know, dad's girlfriends would ignore me, or this, you know, this is how they would fight, and this is how their relationship was. And, you know, I'd have to be like, hey, one, that's their story. So you're copying that, you know, you're the story 2.0. I was like, and that makes sense, you know, especially with my trauma patients. Chaos is comfort to them. So
Yes.
It is very comfortable for some of my patients. And I have to let them know that there is a safe flip side to that. And so usually that's where the work has to happen.
Yeah, because we almost don't recognize as parents or friends or whatever that people follow or engage with model behavior. So, like I said, if you've only ever seen one way of behaving, how would you know there's a different way? How would you know that there's meant to be food in the cupboard, and there's meant to be a parent here in the evening, and there's meant to be all these different things that happen and stuff? But if you never had that, then it's...
You would never know.
Exactly. Yeah. You really don't. Hmm. So a lot of the time when you're at work, you're talking about very challenging situations. I'm sure some of them stay with you longer than others, but how do you And I always wonder this about people that are in caring professions. How do you protect your own mental and physical well-being to make sure that, because I guess you need to show up for your patients, your clients.
Yeah.
So how do you protect your own so you're not carrying this around in your backpack all day and all night?
Yeah. So I, and it's really interesting because my partner's family is like, how do you do this? I am very big on when I'm not working, I'm not working.
Yep.
As soon as I leave, so I work both in community mental health and private practice. When I leave my community mental health space, I'm done. I don't pick up my work phone. I don't answer emails. Even if my boss does have my personal cell phone number and she's never called it, but I'm like, I'm not picking up phone calls from this number. And I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that. It is that clear separation. Thankfully, it's farther out than my home, so I know like the wires never get crossed. Even with in private practice, I'm mostly telehealth, so right here on the cameras and things like that. I do in a very specific piece of my house, and so I'm like, this is my therapy office. When I'm in this space, I'm a therapist. As soon as I walk out, I am regular Brandon, and I don't have to worry. Don't worry about it. Even if I need to reply to emails, I reply to emails first thing in the morning or at the very end of the day. I don't let it kind of mold and meld and kind of become one goo of a day. I'm like, I have to separate it. That's one of my things. And then I have two dogs who love me unconditionally. So usually they get lots of cuddles.
Dogs are pretty good, aren't they? I mean, I've just my dog's just curled up here asleep, which is quite nice. But the I went out before, literally for 5 minutes, and came back, and it was like she'd never seen me for 2 months.
Yeah.
So it is that absolutely unquestioning love that they have for you. And we've got a cat as well, and the cat is very much like, oh, you're here again, are you? It's a very different dynamic, but it is amazing having a dog. That's my meditation, to sitting on the sofa stroking the dog and not thinking about anything.
Yeah.
It really helps. But do you find, and I'm saying this sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, I guess, do you find that you're a little bit like a doctor when his friends sort of say, oh, I've got a rash on my elbow, can you have a quick look at it? People come to you and say, oh, I've been thinking about getting into Bondi. What do you think? Do you find that people perhaps ask you things that you wouldn't necessarily ask your partner?
Yeah, maybe? Or when I tell them I'm a therapist, they're like, you know, I've been a little sad.
No, you're like, oh, gosh. Right, here's the number. Like, ring this number. Book an appointment.
I was like, you know, and I'm usually like, I don't just drop them. I'm not like, okay, well, that's not. I'm usually like, hey, have you tried exercising, running, you know, those things tend to help. Have you tried deep breathing? And they're like, oh no, I haven't. Or yeah, I have. And they're like, well, it just doesn't help. I was like, maybe you should call someone.
Yeah.
Call someone. That's not me. I was like, you're a friend. I can't see you.
Yes.
It's a dual relationship.
Kind of pickle, I guess.
Or I mean, I've had also people, some of my family who's in therapy, they're like, my therapist said this. They're like, is that right? So I was like, that's your therapist. We're all licensed. So it's like, technically we can say whatever, not whatever we want, but we all have our own approaches.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you don't like what your therapist said, I was like, tell them. It's like, I can't change your therapist. Sorry.
No. Thank you so, so much for your openness, kindness and patience. You've been really interesting. And I just wanted to ask, just last of all, what, apart from your dogs, what brings you happiness and joy?
I love being at the beach.
Yeah.
I realized that when I was on vacation, I was actually two or three times I was next to a beach, and I love just like sitting there and just like listening to like the waves. And, you know, I had one AirPod in and I was reading a book. So it was like one ear was kind of doing a little bit of work. One ear was just relaxing and kind of like getting into like the crashing of the waves and stuff like that. I love and just nature in general. I grew up in a part of New York where I was always surrounded by trees, always hiking, always out in nature. So I really appreciate it when I get time away from the city of Los Angeles and be able to get out into like the greener forests.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think nature, and it just makes you put things into perspective. You look out at the ocean and the power the ocean has, and you think, well, just maybe I'm not that important after all. I mean, in a good way, you know, maybe this isn't that good or whatever. And I totally hear you with that. That's totally true. I won't take up your entire day. So thank you so much. You were very, very kind, and I learned a lot, and hopefully people listening to will recognize things, will understand things, and will be curious, really. And we both said before we started, it is about being curious and not judgmental, curious. We can ask questions, we can learn things. There's so many places to go and learn things these days. That's what we need to do, really, to make people more empathic and make society a better place, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.